Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Detroit Mayor Dave Bing has made it official, announcing this afternoon he will not run for re-election as mayor. On today's show, what this means for the city currently under emergency management, what happens going forward. And then reports show a baby's chance of living past his or her first birthday in our state largely depends on the color of that baby's skin. We'll take a look at Michigan's high rate of infant mortality. But first, to West Michigan. That's where crews are trying to figure out what caused the release of slightly radioactive water from the Palisades nuclear power plant in southwest Michigan. This plant was shut down a little over a week ago because of that leak. And crews say they have discovered a new crack in a water tank that's been leaking on and off for the past 2 years. Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith joins us now. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thanks.
So here we are. We're talking about Palisades again. We had West Michigan Congressman Fred Upton and a nuclear regulatory commissioner touring the plant yesterday. So what do you hear is the latest?
Well, the latest is they're working to figure out what the actual problem is. They have identified one crack that is new. It's about, Fred Upton described it as about a half an inch long and as wide as his thumbnail. And this is in one of the nozzles that's in the tank that lets the water come out under normal circumstances. So, but they're not sure that that's the only problem, and they are still investigating, essentially.
So to the average person listening to this, you hear that radioactive water is leaking from this power plant into a pond that flows into Lake Michigan. It sounds pretty scary. Can you put this into context for us, just how dangerous was this?
Yeah, I mean, this definitely grabbed a lot of attention, but it really isn't that bad. You know, regulators have said time and time again that there is no risk to public safety. When it first happened, they didn't know exactly how radioactive the water is. They've come out with a figure since then that puts it at less than 1/50,000th of the federal limit for an entire year for exposure to radiation from a nuclear power plant. Now, I should say, you know, you get exposed to radiation from the sun, from all kinds of things on a daily basis, and all nuclear plants have these planned releases of radioactive water or gases, and those are allowed. They're only allowed to have so much per year. So this will come out of their total allotted amount of radioactive water that they can release in a year.
Now, this is not the first time, Lindsay, we've had you on. As I was saying at the top of this interview, we've been talking about what's happening at Palisades. It's had numerous shutdowns. In fact, if I'm right, 9 since 2011, and the plant shut down about a year ago to fix this same tank. So what's one to make from all of this?
Well, I mean, certainly Palisades has had some problems. They were on the list of one of the worst performing plants as far as safety rating goes in the country until last December. They upgraded the safety rating that the regulators did. They have put aside special resources for the plant, even though they have upgraded the safety rating. But, you know, it is kind of concerning. I mean, certainly I have been on this as far as they have tried to fix this tank before. They were under the impression that these nozzles that they've got these cracks in now, we're not going to get new cracks in them. The NRC says, you know, they've got inspectors on site, people that specialize in this kind of thing. But they had these specialists on site last time, last June, when they shut down the plant to fix the same tank. So, you know, when I tried to press them a little bit more on this on Monday, you know, how can we kind of, you know, I mean, you're going through the same thing. They really don't have anything else besides their line of, we will continue to monitor the plant and make sure that it's operating safely. So, yes, they still have their eye on it. But they've had their eye on it, so I don't know if it means that they can prevent this kind of thing in the future or not.
And what are you hearing from the people who have to live around the Palisades plant? What are they saying to you?
Well, they, you know, residents sort of know this drill, I think, by now. There's plenty who are not happy about the plant's performance. There was a pretty small protest, I would say, yesterday, about a dozen people. And they, I would say they're happy to see Fred Upton bring some attention to the plant, although I have heard some people who say it's kind of a, you know, he has no choice, that it's bad PR at this point if he doesn't, you know, reach out and say, hey, I'm on top of this. So, I mean, residents know they've been dealing with this. They get kind of frustrated because it's, you know, like you said, it's sort of over and over and over again.
As you say, they know the drill all too well. So where we're standing right now, the Palisades plant is closed. They're not really sure why there's a crack and what else is going on. So any clue, any idea when the plant will restart again?
No. Short answer is no. They usually won't say anyway because the company doesn't, they consider it kind of private information. But they, at the press conference that they had this week, they didn't say that they would be done with their investigation this week, even. They had hoped to, but once they get investigation done, they're still going to have to figure out what is the best solution. And then putting that solution in place could take, I mean, the last time this tank was leaking, it was shut down for a month. So it could be shut down for a month. It could be shut down for longer.
Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith keeping an ever watchful eye on the Palisades nuclear power plant. Good talking with you, Lindsay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the speculation, the guessing is over. Detroit Mayor Dave Bing announced this afternoon he will not run for re-election. Bing spent close to 20 minutes outlining his successes before, finally, announcing he will not run for another term as mayor. Nancy Kaffer is the editorial writer for the Detroit Free Press, and she joins us now. Nancy, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, Nancy, the last time we had you on, Dave Bing had picked up the filing papers he needed to run again for mayor, and a lot of people said, oh, it looks like he's going to do it, but that's certainly not how things turned out. Any idea what happened?
If I did, my stuff would be the most read stuff in the world because I'd be psychic or something. You know, I think that at the time when we spoke and he had just picked up the papers, a lot of people said, that's it, he's running, and we had to actually, if I recall, recalibrate our conversation because we realized that that was actually not what he was saying. It was that just he had simply picked up petitions and would decide at a later date if he were going to run. This has been a couple of weeks of where the will here, won't he, had been intensified with people saying, would he get these petitions if he wasn't going to run? Would he be getting signatures if he wasn't going to run? Would he be holding an event at the Wright Museum of African American History if he wasn't going to run? And the answer, of course, turned out to be yes, he would do all those things if he wasn't going to run.
And it took him quite a while to cut to the chase, like something like 20 minutes before he actually made it official. Is that is it unusual, or is that kind of a typical Dave Bing speechifying tactic?
You know what? The mayor is normally a very succinct speaker, and I was not actually there at the event, I should say. I was following it remotely via Twitter and via our reporting, and I was going nuts. I'm thinking it started at 12. He should have come across with the goods by now. But, you know, the mayor is normally a very succinct speaker. He's not someone who really enjoys this rhetorical, you know, long-windedness that some people seem to. He's normally pretty, gets to the punch pretty quickly. So yeah. I'd say that is not usual for him.
Well, does that maybe lead into the fact that he said he's going to establish an exploratory committee to examine, quote, other options, including the office of Wayne County Executive? So it seems like he's not ready necessarily to hang up a career in politics.
I will note that there is not actually a legal thing called an exploratory committee in Michigan campaign finance law. A lot of people say that they're going to establish an exploratory committee, and that's not actually, you can have a candidate committee, but in the sense that a presidential candidate establishes an exploratory committee, that's not a thing in local. It's a term people use sort of loosely for, I'm thinking about running.
Okay.
And I'm going to talk to some folks and see what they say. Is he serious about running for Wayne County Executive? I don't know what to say about that. That is, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about what will happen when Wayne County Executive Robert Fracano is up for reelection, and there's certainly been a lot of troubling activity in Wayne County government with people being indicted and an ongoing federal corruption scheme. I think it's very widely perceived that Fracano is vulnerable. But the other caveat to that has also been that he's not up for election until next year. And depending on how Fracano emerges from this investigation, he's not been charged with anything. It's all very up in the air.
Let's get back to the race for Detroit mayor, because that move today of saying I'm not running certainly has impact. In your view, how does this affect and shake up the race for mayor of Detroit?
Well, that's another good question. So the two front runners in this election are obviously Mike Duggan, formerly of the DMC, formerly Wayne County prosecutor, and Benny Napoleon, former Detroit police chief, current Wayne County sheriff, are obviously the two front runners. Duggan moved to the city specifically to run. Napoleon has neighborhood cred. And so there has been a lot of speculation that Napoleon would get sort of the, you know, it was in line to get sort of the old school Detroit vote. I don't know how Mayor Bing's presence in that lineup would have changed things, because the mayor also moved to the city to run and dealt with some of the same issues that
and innuendos
has dealt with, right, of being a carpetbagger or whatnot. How all these things would have played out is, well, we'll never find out, because we're not going to have that three-man race.
There we go. Nancy Kaffer, editorial writer with the Detroit Free Press. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I think a lot of us would agree that one of the most frustrating aspects of living in America in 2013 is the way that we seem to have lost a sense of being on the same team. Instead of thinking of ourselves as Americans or Michiganians, all too often it's Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, Tea Party, Christian, Muslim, and so on. And the result seems to be such a deep sense of division, of gridlock in Congress and in Lansing, of flinging blame instead of building solutions, a fear that somehow we've lost our way and we've become divided and we've become cynical. My next guest addresses these fears and what he believes needs to happen to break down walls between factions and groups and tribes and get us moving as one nation, one state, one people. He believes we need to focus on the common good. His book is entitled On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good, published by Brazos Press. He grew up in Detroit. He lives and teaches in Washington, D.C. these days. He is an author, a theologian, a preacher, social activist. Jim Wallace joins us now in the studio. Jim, welcome to Stateside.
Great to be home, and I can tell you've read the book.
I have indeed. I think there's a lot of good messages that we're going to get to talk about. And I want to have you start, Jim, by get us on the same page, everybody listening. When you talk about the greater good, what do you mean?
You know, I went away on sabbatical to write this book, and my discipline was not to write or speak or be interviewed about the political narrative for the first 3 months of the election year. It was tough discipline, but I kept it. And every morning I'd get up early and have quiet and exercise, and I'd read and write all day, but I'd watch the news cycle at night. Mm-hmm. The more disengaged I was, and the more I watched, the more depressing it seemed. The polarization, the vitriol, the shallowness on politics and the media, the hate talk, really. And it really struck me how we've lost this ancient idea called the common good. And it goes back in all our traditions, Catholic social teaching. It's Umuntu in Africa. It's everywhere. It means that we are all responsible for all. It means our neighbor is finally the test of our life together. The line of the book, the opening line, expresses the hunger people feel. Our life together can be better. So I'm going around the country. It's really a common good tour as much as a book tour. And I'm hearing the hunger is so deep for this, but the cynicism about politics is also very deep.
And it's something that you don't have to look very far at all to get that sense of cynicism, which makes, I think, citizens and makes us feel like, gee, the wheels are coming off the wagon here.
I think so. What I'm saying in the book is skepticism is a good thing. Be skeptical of Washington and Wall Street, for example. But cynicism is a spiritually dangerous thing, because cynicism is a buffer against personal commitment. You know, we say, I can't change, so I'll step back, surround myself with some more security, and I'll just not be as engaged. I think the powers that be almost like us to be cynical, to not engage them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm talking about how ordinary people can make decisions in their families, their schools, their workplaces, their congregations, their neighborhoods, that can build the kind of social movements that only change politics, abolition, women's suffrage, civil rights. Right now, the one thing going to happen in D.C. that's any good is by August recess, I'm predicting we'll have comprehensive immigration reform, not because of Washington, but in spite of it. Mm-hmm. Movements on the outside have made Washington listen to this system is so broken, we have to fix it. But they're not listening until we make ourselves heard. But so decisions we make in our lives, I think, can build a common good.
When we talk about a country or us as a state united for the common good, have we had that happen in our history?
It happens around tough questions. It happened around civil rights. It was hard. It was long. Doesn't come easily. But when you ask the right question, like Lincoln, I quote in the front of the book, "My concern is not whether God is on our side. My greatest concern is to be on God's side." Lincoln didn't always know what that meant, but he flipped the question. We always want to bring God onto our side in religion and politics. He says, no, wrestle with what it means to be on God's side. Same with the common good. I can't sit here, Cynthia, and say these 10 things are the common good. Agree with me. But it's the right question. Let's not ask what's in. If it's just taking care of myself, my group, my tribe, my nation, my party, we'll be in trouble. Unless we learn how to take care of each other and the neighbor is extended beyond our group and our tribe, then we're in serious trouble. So the common good is really we're all going to be responsible for all here and then have a debate, a good political debate about the issues. That's fine if the common good is our goal, not winning and losing for our political sides, our donors. D.C. is funded by wealthy extremists who control the debate. And most people that I meet in the road feel politically homeless. They don't really are drawn. They cast a vote as best we can, and they may strongly believe in this candidate, but they don't really feel like they've got a home in politics.
And when you see the public approval ratings, Congress, and also we have that in Michigan with the state legislature, there is that sense of disconnect. The book is On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good, written by my guest, Jim Wallace. So let's break down the title. What has religion forgotten? And what price are we paying as a state and as a nation because of that?
Well, this is the most biblical and theological book I've written for some time. Yet I also want to say that religion has no monopoly on morality. So at all these book events, people say at the end, they say, well, I'm an agnostic on my good days, atheist on some other days. But I wondered if I'd feel welcome in the conversation tonight, and I really did. So the spiritual foundation for the common good is the second commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. And that, I was on sabbatical, a dad, 10-year-old Little League baseball coach. I got to thinking, that really means I can love Luke and Jack with all my heart and soul. I never thought I could love anything or anyone as much as I do them. And that's good, but it means I got to love other people's kids as well. What does that mean? That's a transformational ethic, and it was supposed to be. So the secular equivalent is the golden rule in our democratic secular tradition. So we can have the conversation across all our boundaries. And I think we got to say what is good for all of us, not just our identity and tribe or class. So this is what the common good really challenges all of us to look past our noses and our own group to see what's best for all of us here. And we won't always agree, but that should be the framework. That's the question. That's the context of the debate.
And you point out in your book, Jim, that all too often when you look at what religion is today, it's too white, it's too privileged, it's too male, it's too American.
And again, God, bringing God onto our side. I talk a lot in the book about who Jesus was and whether it matters. I say this, I'm a Christian. So the kind of Jesus we believe in will determine the kind of Christians we are. So let's look at what he said and did and whether that shapes our faith or not. But I've got my dearest friend in D.C. is a rabbi, and we work together. And I was with a young Muslim in Chicago who's a good friend of mine. So we can move together across boundaries. But here's what happens when people of faith actually do and say what their faith says we should say and do. People are surprised, and then they're attracted. So I'm writing this book to people, some of whom are skeptical, are none of the above, the fastest growing affiliation in the religious world. And I love those nuns because they're really asking the hard questions. And so this is written in part to them to see what does it mean to have a faith that serves the common good, not just ourselves.
And politics. What has politics not learned? And what does that look like in Michigan in 2013?
Well, let me put it starkly. In politics, the checks have replaced all the balances in our public life. And so I have senators who tell me they have to raise $20,000 on average per day to get reelected. Now, I know your senators here. I know them all over the country. Mm-hmm. And this money's control over politics is a deeply serious problem. The common good won't be served until we can break the hold of money over politics. We have to talk about that out loud and talk about how we can change that. I have a whole chapter on that called Redeeming Democracy. Then you apply it to the economy, what I call the uneconomy, unfair, unsustainable, unstable. You know about that here in mm-hmm. Michigan, mm-hmm. and making many people unhappy. It's the uneconomy. What would it mean to restore economic trust in how and where decisions are made? So I try to apply all these things to practical issues and see how we can really lift up the common good, elevate the common good to our political discussion.
What do you think, and you spelled it out in your book, and I want you to tell us, continuing really with politics and with religion, what is the best big conservative idea?
You know, by the way, Cynthia has all these marks, these little tabs in the book. And I talk to radio people sometimes who just, you know, they're glad to even show, talk about your book, but they don't really haven't read it. You've read this book. This is great. I appreciate that. The best conservative idea is personal responsibility. The best liberal idea is social responsibility.
And can we marry those two?
We have to. I mean,
how?
Well, we're at war. We're having this left-right war. So I'm saying, don't go left, don't go right, go deeper. Mm. I mean, how do we find things, what's right and what works, as opposed to what's left and what's right? For example, I've lived in poor neighbors most of my life, and I've never seen people or families lift themselves out of poverty without taking some personal responsibility for that. But they also can't do it without a context that offers them that possibility, mm-hmm. social responsibility, some social assistance in context. So we need both to do this. And so the book talks about everything from strengthening, you know, marriage and parenting, because I'm, you know, that's a big deal for me as a dad, to making the economy have more opportunity for people to really, you know, succeed. So how do we marry these, the best of both ideas, and away from the extremes and away from the ideological sort of politics of both the left and the right?
What do we need to do as consumers of media in choosing how we consume news and entertainment? And I guess, you know, also the other side of that coin is, what should the media be doing to help further this instead of make things worse?
Well, I'll tell you very specifically, on this tour, the best conversations I've had have been on radio shows like this that are longer than 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, mm-hmm. and we can have a serious conversation. The media, if you switch the channels, you see a different content, but the tone is very similar. The attacking, the hatred, and politicians are afraid of the pundits on their side. And too many people go to the media sources that just fuel their existing prejudices, and they don't really want to hear the other side. Read a broader range of people, and we have to create our own media. Sojourners, our sojo.net, is our own media platform, and 250,000 people every week plug in all of that, and we're trying to raise up a different view than people see in the media that's controlled by fewer and fewer people. So the media has to be a town meeting. What this show is here, from what I've heard of what you do every day, it's a town meeting. It's a town meeting for people in Michigan to talk about our public life, the quality of our mm-hmm. public life, arts and culture and religion and politics, and what's the quality of our life together. That's what the media has to provide space for, and this book tour is trying to do that.
I was talking about your book with someone over the weekend, and who's very politically aware and committed and concerned. And his question was, could one not argue that the kind of the digging in and the drawing lines by whatever political group you pick mm-hmm. is for the common good, in their view, that each side very much believes that the stance it's taking and what it's doing is indeed for the common good of the state or common good of the country?
I wish I believed that, because I think it's usually for the self-interest of the people who are writing the checks and paying for politics. I live in Washington, D.C., and I don't hear them asking that question. They're asking who wins and who loses. And politics is more about campaigning all the time, now than governing. It's not about how do we solve – well, I'll be very specific. On immigration, I've had Republicans and Democrats, senators, look me in the eye and say, okay, Jim, now the way we'd normally do this is to help us win the next election. But we're listening to the faith community and what you're saying, and we're going to promise you on this one, we're going to do what it takes to get a bipartisan bill to fix this broken system where there's 11 million vulnerable people, as you remind us, who are stuck between these two signs at the border. One says no trespass, one says help wanted, right?
Yeah.
So they're right in the middle. So they're saying on this one, they're going to do the right thing and fix it. And they're also saying to me privately, they're saying, if we get this done, they're almost giddy about doing something positive for change and doing something together.
That isn't going to be reviled.
Yeah. And if they say, if we get this done, maybe it'll affect other things too. Now, I hope it does, but the common good comes last to Washington. I mean, K Street has all these, there are three pharmaceutical lobbyists for every single member of Congress. That's one industry. Now, there aren't very many lobbyists in D.C. for low-income moms and kids. You know, they're not there. That's really the job, I think, of the faith community, to raise that kind of question. So the book talks about, you know, how you lift up the idea of the Good Samaritan. You know, the Good Samaritan goes global is a chapter here. Well, we get in Bangladesh, we had the collapse of a clothing factory, and the clothes on our backs are being made by people who this is happening to. Are they our neighbor, as the Good Samaritan parable asks? A lawyer asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? And you don't know this, but he was a Washington lawyer who asked that question. I can tell that tone of voice. Who's my neighbor? I'm not responsible. And Jesus points to this Good Samaritan who stopped and helped a stranger. And so are we neighbors to those who make our clothes or whose minerals in the Congo are necessary to our cell phones? Are they our neighbor? I say they are.
The book is called On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good, by New York Times bestselling author Jim Wallace. Finally, do you feel truly in your heart that these kinds of changes can happen, or is it like trying in America in 2013, or is this like, are you the voice in the wilderness?
Well, I've been that sometimes, but, you know, I was in South Africa 10 years before the inauguration of Nelson Mandela, and I was interrogated by the South African security police who were thugs, and I knew how desperate that situation was. My friend and mentor Desmond Tutu, the Archbishop, he taught me the difference between hope and optimism. Optimism is just how things look and they feel, and good day, bad day. Hope is a decision you make because of this thing called faith. So I met kids in Soweto in black townships 10 years before Mandela was inaugurated. And I said, will your children breathe free air in South Africa? 14-year-old kids looked me in the eye and said, I will see to it. And I knew apartheid was dead at that point. It took 10 years. I've seen too much change. Immigration is going to pass. I was a kid in the civil rights movement, but I was a kid who saw that happen. So the book is full of hopeful stories. Hope is a decision we make because of whatever it is that we call faith. And that's what changes history time and time and time again.
Jim Wallace, it was a pleasure talking with you on
Great
Stateside.
Great to be here, Cynthia.
Thank you. His newest book is On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Author Jim Wallace will be at the Baker Bookhouse in Grand Rapids tonight at 7. Well, here is a troubling fact. The infant mortality rate in Michigan has been persistently higher than the national average. Add to that the fact that a baby born to a black mother in our state is almost 3 times more likely to die before its first birthday than a baby born to a white mother. Health experts look at these numbers and they tell us, using a 3-year moving average for Michigan's mortality rate for African American babies, we're behind every advanced nation, tucked between countries like Malaysia and Syria. Joining me here in the studio is Arlene Geronimus. She's a professor of health behavior and health education at the University of Michigan. She also works with the Institute for Social Research. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And joining us from Detroit is Brenda Jagaday. She's the project coordinator for PRIME. That stands for Practice to Reduce Infant Mortality Through Equity, and it's with the Michigan Department of Community Health. Brenda, welcome to Stateside.
Hello. Thank you.
Good to have you both with us. Arlene, you have been observing and studying this problem of Michigan's infant mortality rate and the disparity between white babies and babies of color for decades, and even 30 years ago, you advanced a hypothesis to explain this disparity. What did you mean by weathering, which at the time was not met with very much support?
The weathering hypothesis was suggesting that women in different, what I would call social locations, and I'll explain that in a moment, age at different rates. And by age, I'm not talking about just aging of the elderly as we think of it, but even through youth and young adulthood. And so that groups in more marginalized social locations, so that would include African Americans, it would include people in high poverty communities, mm-hmm. it would include a whole range of different groups, but I have focused the most in this particular problem we're talking about is most clear in the African American population, mm-hmm. that they begin to develop diseases and conditions at younger ages and startling younger ages than women in more privileged positions. And these conditions affect pregnancy. Some of them that people are familiar with, such as high blood pressure, are one of the biggest risk factors for having a poor birth outcome. And I described rates of hypertension among Black women that were not just higher than white, which many people already knew, but that the age dimension of that disparity enlarged exactly over the reproductive ages. And so if you think about hypertension or high blood pressure as, first of all, a stress-related disease, you can begin to understand why groups who have less and who are subject to racism or other types of marginalization would have more exposure to and need to cope actively with stressors. If you then realize that there's less medical care available to these very same women, and then if you add to it that it's the leading cause of stillbirths and neonatal mortality, the early mm-hmm. infant
early,
mortality,
yes.
you can see kind of this convergence of situations where it makes a very big difference what the rates of chronic disease are in young adult reproductive age women.
Mm-hmm. Brenda Jagade, there you are, working with Practice to Reduce Infant Mortality Through Equity with PRIME. One's first inclination might be to think that education and poverty are the explanation behind the difference in infant mortality rates, but you are working in the field with people. Why is that not true?
Well, I would say that we definitely believe that education and what we call those social determinants of health do have a definite factor. But we're looking at all of those things as we talked about those social determinants of health. When Arlene was talking, it made me think about that. And what we've been looking at is also what we call the life course, where we're trying to look and see in terms of impacting health outcomes, not just looking at that 9 months of pregnancy, but looking at the lifetime health of a woman to be able to impact those health outcomes. So we've, in the Practices to Reduce Infant Mortality Through Equity Project, we've been trying to understand concepts like health equity and institutional racism and how that plays into the policies and procedures that we develop at the state level and how that impacts women and families and their health outcomes.
So what does that institutional racism and the inequities that you're speaking of, what does that look like in everyday life, Brenda?
When we talk about institutional racism, which was a whole process for us at the state health department, we went through a series of training, one from the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. We went to their Undoing Racism training, and we also participated in Ingham County Health Department's Health Equity and Social Justice workshops. So we're looking at trying to do business different. How can we do things differently than we have in the past? Because as we stated, for decades, several decades, we haven't reduced those racial disparities. So we're looking at the conditions, the social, the economic conditions in which people live, and looking at how that impacts their health.
So we say, I think I'm hearing, you can have a mom who's 30 years old, she's well-educated, she makes good mm-hmm. money, she's African-American, and then you have the same mom and she's white, and the African-American mom still has a higher chance of infant death. Arlene, what does that say about Michigan in 2013?
Well, it says that we don't understand yet that true equality isn't just about if you have a certain education or income. That, in fact, there are other factors that affect your health in particular and stress-related diseases and poor birth outcomes that come from the fact that that 30-year-old black woman probably or is more likely to have had to work much harder to get where she is, has to work harder to achieve as much, is probably paid less than someone else, and then has may or may not have the same opportunities in terms of promotions, glass ceilings instead of promotions, or even places to live because we have a very segregated, residentially segregated areas in Michigan and throughout the United States, but Michigan and Detroit in particular, it's very segregated. And so in addition to all the various kind of direct or material ways that will affect that black woman versus the white woman, it also means the black woman is dealing on a kind of psychosocial level. So that takes a lot of energy, both psychic energy, but it's also just literally physiologically activates stress processes in people that then erode, cause weathering, cause wear and tear on a whole range of body systems, lead to dysregulated blood pressure, blood sugar, both of which are very risky in terms of reproductive health. And then the last part I just want to put in here is that it is more likely that this white 30-year-old woman has grown up in a community, in a background, which is socialized to kind of fit in and understand, to kind of get the memos without having those memos have to be written. Black women and other marginalized groups, immigrants, poor white women who have been upwardly mobile, a whole range of what I'm calling marginalized groups.
They're not getting
those
memos.
Didn't get the memo, right. And they don't, not quite sure if when they're not understanding something or fitting in, it's because they're making some big mistakes or they just didn't get a memo or what's it about. And all of that can cause stress reactivity.
I would just add, when you mentioned the memo, it just made me think that the memo wasn't written for them. You know, sometimes populations of color, when you just look at our history, so a lot of our policies and procedures and the way we do business wasn't necessarily based on our populations, you know, of color. And when you were mentioning the importance of education, and I would say, you know, education and income, how we know the data tells us that you do better, you live longer, the better educated you are, the more income that you have. However, you know, when you look at, you know, the data that shows that an African-American woman with a higher education, with a college education, has poorer birth outcomes than a white woman who hasn't finished high school, you have to start asking yourself questions. Well, why is that? What's happening?
And what needs to be, I guess that what we really want to take away is especially here you are working with the Michigan Department of Community Health, Brenda, with this PRIME project. What needs to be done to close that gap?
I would say one of the things that we're doing is, one, making ourselves aware that it's not just these individual behaviors to, you know, understand the impact that stress has on populations of color. So we've started looking at our policies and procedures. So I want to give an example, like one example when people think about institutional. What do you mean by institutional? And I think about the fact that we were able to do our first state standalone PRAMS in the Native American community. And this is a survey of all mothers who deliver, and we really look at this survey to tell us a lot about their health and how we can reduce infant mortality and adverse birth outcomes. But we find that because a population such as the Native Americans is such a small population that we really don't get information on them to be able to even know what to do in terms of implementing programs, developing programs for them. So in partnering with our Intertribal Council of Michigan, they've helped us to understand how they've had to use some alternative methods to better, you know, describe the maternal child health of the Native American community. And one method that they used was looking at the race of a mother or a father as recorded as Native American on the birth certificate. This is not our policy. This is not how we do business. And there's a whole lot of reasons why, which are understandable. However, when we do this and just go about our normal way of doing things, we neglect to get the information that we need. And so in just looking at this alternative policy, we were able to get 108% increase in the sampling size to women that we could send the survey to in Michigan. So that's 1,300 more women that we might find out information about and actually be able to develop some programming around them. So that's an example of trying to do something different to close the gaps.
Arlene Geronimus, from where you sit, what do you think needs to be done in terms of educating healthcare providers? What do healthcare providers need to be shown and taught and do differently than has been done in the past?
I think there's several things. I think one of the things in terms of clinical care is there's also just a dynamic between the clinician and the pregnant woman. And that dynamic itself, that interaction between them, can have implications for her health and her pregnancy. Not just did he pick up the right diagnosis and give the right treatment, but how did he or she ask the right questions? Did they make the person feel comfortable? Did they just assume that they must have some bad behaviors or bad cultural practices that are causing if they're having problems? Do they think about whether the recommendations they make for them are ones that can be fulfilled? Are there places to go buy the foods they need to eat to have a healthy pregnancy? I think also we have to open up the social determinants, not only to include what I'm calling, I guess, as psychosocial, the things that raise these stress levels, but also there's more and more evidence of environmental impacts on birth outcomes. And this is another version of institutionalized racism to some extent, which is the areas in which our segregation has occurred in Michigan have tended to segregate people of color, not only in low-income communities, but places where there's lots of diesel fuel, where there's high lead level concentrations, where there's very little access to healthy foods, but lots of access to fast foods or to liquor stores. So one of the striking things I think in Michigan is while the black rate has remained the highest and white infant mortality has been catching up in some places.
Brandy,
yeah, I would definitely agree just in terms of looking at a population, you know, looking at population health versus individual health and you know, how sometimes we will say, or, you know, some researchers have said, you know, I can tell you more so about your health and your life expectancy if you give me your zip code versus your DNA code. That really may not, you know, tell me as much as that will, because we're looking at all those things, you know, in addition to education and employment, but housing and transportation, you know, all of those things that impact health. And one of the things that we've learned from our local learning collaborative, the importance of partnering with the organizations in their community that provide all of the services around transportation, housing, education, or, you know, jobs, things of that nature, that had to take place in order to overall improve the health of those within their communities and for them to have the best health outcomes.
My final question, and I really like the thoughts of both of you. I'll start with you, Arlene. Let's go ahead 5 to 10 years. What kind of conversation do you hope or do you think we'll be having about infant mortality in Michigan?
Well, given how entrenched this problem has been for so many decades, unfortunately, we will probably still be having a conversation about how the rates are too high for anybody in Michigan and the disparities are too great. But I guess what I would hope would be different from the past is that there's an evolution towards understanding You need to look at population level and not just individual behavior. You have to think about women's health throughout their life course and not just the 9 months they're pregnant. That clinical interventions matter, but they're actually a very small piece. And so we should be putting more effort into some of these broader social and environmental issues.
And from where you sit, Brenda Jagaday, give me a sense of what you hope we'll be talking about in 5 to 10 years.
That is hard, but in 5 to 10 years, I would love to see that we have made some progress in terms of reducing the racial disparities. And as Arlene said, you know, more around population health, discussions around programming around population health, funding in that area, and looking at the life course. So just making people healthy from the onset. I think we, you know, we'll have such tremendous gain if we made that change. Also, within the department, I would like to see that in that time period, these concepts are no longer new for us. They're second nature, that when we're looking at our programming, our policies, and our procedures, that, you know, this is something that we automatically do, and that we're not as uncomfortable talking about race, because a lot of times we bring race in it. It opens up a whole another can of worms that I think we continue to deal with in this country.
I've been speaking with Brenda Jagaday. She's the project coordinator for PRIME, which stands for Practice to Reduce Infant Mortality Through Equity, and it's with the Michigan Department of Community Health. She joined us from Detroit. And Arlene Geronimus, professor of health behavior and health education at the University of Michigan, she joined us in the studio. Thank you so much to both of you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.